and welcome to Mindset, an HCD vidcast, where we dive into the world of applied consumer neuroscience and market research with leading experts in the field. My name is Michelle Nagella, PhD in behavioral neuroscience and Director of Research and Innovation at HCD.
And I'm Catherine Ambrose, the Manager of Behavioral and Marketing Sciences with HCD. As your hosts, we are going to act as the buzzkills for the buzzwords, taking time to critically think about the limitations and pitfalls of emerging trends and topics within the field to help you identify what innovation has a lot of untapped potential or is too good to be true.
Now, HCD is a full-service research house which provides research capabilities on consumers by looking at how they perceive, evaluate, and respond to different types of stimuli, such as looking at product experiences, communications, or just general consumer and shopper experiences. We use a combination of tools that come from psychology, physiology, neuroscience, as well as the traditional methods that people typically use to see how they experience different stimuli. That stimuli can range from the early stages of exploration all the way through the final product validation tests. This is what we refer to as applied consumer neuroscience.
So stick around for more curious conversations as we chat our way through the ever-evolving space of consumer science.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mindset Season. Well, we're calling it season three, but I'm so happy to be here with you. My name is Catherine Ambrose, and unfortunately, I don't have my partner in science with me, Michelle, but I am being joined today by a very exciting guest. We have Dr. Elizabeth Johnson, Zab. I'll let her introduce herself, but we're really excited to chat with her. She is a professor at Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania, where I am currently studying for my master's in behavioral and decision science. But without further ado, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Catherine. It's nice to be here.
Awesome. And would you mind just sharing a little bit about exactly who you are, what your origin story is?
Sure. I mean, that would be a long story, but I'll try and synopsize it and make it quick. So I have a background. I have a PhD in neuroscience, which I got at NYU. And then I went on to do a standard postdoc fellowship at Duke University, had this amazing opportunity to start something called the Duke Institute for Brain Sciences when that first launched back in 2008. And that initiative, that institute was really working across the whole campus to you know, sort of instill neuroscience in every aspect of academia, from the humanities to law to business to medicine. So that was really amazing. And then in 2016, I moved to the University of Pennsylvania, where I now serve as the executive director of something called the Wharton Neuroscience Initiative. And I'm also a senior fellow in the Wharton Neuroscience Initiative, and I co-instruct a class in Wharton in the marketing department called Visual Marketing with my co-conspirator, Dr. Barbara Kahn, who's a retail expert. So that's a little bit of my origin story.
That's awesome. Thank you so much. There's so much in there that I want to dive into and check out. You have so many cool experiences throughout your life. But I want to ask a bit, what made you so passionate about including neuroscience into every facet, into every discipline? Why were you drawn to that?
I was really drawn to the sort of 20,000 foot view of how neuroscience could impact our lives, our societies, and our businesses. So I was really interested actually in the sort of applied aspect of neuroscience. And I have thought a lot about the fact that that even though, you know, everyone carries around one of these 6 or 7 pound organs inside their heads, a lot of people don't know they're very much about their own brains, and yet they guide our behavior. You know, they're at the root of how we make our decisions. They really are, at the helm of how we interact with each other. To me, it was just fascinating to start to think about ways that I could engage broader community to really empower them to think about their own brains and their own processing, and to think about how understanding more about neuroscience could actually impact, again, everything from the way that we live our daily lives to how our societies are organized and how our businesses are run.
It's so true. I think that that's a really common misconception about neuroscience, is that it's, because we want to compartmentalize everything, that's who we are, like, as people, but neuroscience is innately interdisciplinary. There's so many features of it that, you know, I joke around with some of my past students that I've been with, that when you say neuroscience, people are like, oh, that's so fancy. But I'm like, neuroscience is psychology, is anthropology, is, you know, is computer science. Like, they're all connected. It's just where you're specializing, where you're looking, what your focus really wants to be on. And I think it's really impressive that you were able to bring this to an institution like Wharton, because that is something that is lacking in the industry. And as I was personally going through my journey of deciding where I want to end up, it was, you know, I recognized that there was that gap between industry and academia. And I think it's great that you're almost bridging it by offering it to people that their focus isn't to really become professors, but they want to take it and apply it to different companies. So can you speak a little bit more about what that's been like for you, and maybe any challenges or experiences you've had?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I agree 100%. I mean, neuroscience, it is a relatively new scientific discipline. And I think just because of the complexity of the brain, it really does require a multidisciplinary approach. And we've got a long ways to go. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things that we do understand. There are a lot of things that we don't.
Right.
There are still so many mysteries. But I think that the analytics and the data that we have by sort of looking underneath the hood, as it were, beyond behavior, has been really informative for a lot of different aspects. So the Wharton Neuroscience Initiative is really, our main crux is to build better business through brain science. And we do that, you know, by hopefully also to sort of make businesses more efficient, more effective, and also more humane. So again, sort of reprioritizing the humans that are both, you know, the employees of our businesses, but also the consumers, right? In the context of consumer neuroscience, that to think again about the people that we're impacting, and how, you know, neuroscience can help inform that. So we have, you know, research portfolio. Of course, we're at an academic university, so we prioritize academic research. We have applied research as well, the biggest push, of course, is academic publishable findings, and we engage people at all different levels in that research, you know, from undergraduate students all the way up through our faculty colleagues and even some of our business partners. And then, of course, we have educational mission as well, and that's not to turn the sort of standard Wharton students or all Penn students into neuroscience or neuroscientists, but to sort of inspire a new generation to think about how neuroscience might impact, their lives, their work, their beings as they go out into the world, and really become the ambassadors for where this could go. And then, of course, like our third pillar really is engagement and outreach. And that's to sort of build a community at large, both within and outside of the university, to begin to have dialogues about, you know, what the future is, the ethical concerns, mm-hmm. and the possibilities and the potential impacts as well.
Oh, absolutely. And there's quite a few things you said there again that really resonate with the things that HCD believes in as well, because we recognize that there is this consumer-centric model that really should be at the forefront of product development and marketing and communications. And a lot of times when you have companies, they forget that there is a human at the end of the whatever it is that you're trying to create or sell or invent. And, you know, sometimes in losing sight of that, you end up not making a product or whatever it is to meet the needs of people, because that's what it comes down to. It comes down to who are the people, how are they, how is this going to help their lifestyles, and you know, how is it going to better society in general? Like you said, we are much more than just, you know, walking brains. Like, the brains interact with other brains that are humans, and it, you know, it builds and builds from there. So it's a very challenging thing to try to understand, but when you break it down really simply, it does come to just trying to understand the human behavior and having that, how it influences other people. And I think that it's really, really interesting. And I'm curious, so this initiative that you have at Wharton, is it based for the Wharton community, or is it available to other individuals, or how is it kind of branching out, kind of how you were saying, to get that network?
Yeah, there are lots of different ways to engage with us, and one does not have to be a student even at Wharton or at Penn to do so. We have multiple ways that we try and reach out to people and involve people. I mean, I think one of the most exciting things about it, right, is the engagement actually with people in the broader business community as well, right? Because academics, they sort of, sometimes they know what some of the challenges are, but it's sort of a thought experiment and may or may not be reality. And, you know, I have spent my entire life, right, with sort of within academia and the ivory tower. And so it's really essential actually to have conversations with people who are out there at the forefront of business, really thinking about what are the greatest challenges, and then to put a sort of neuroscience lens on that. So we sort of rely on a community and a back and forth dialogue. So we do that through, we also have our own podcast, and we have a series of events that we like to put on, where we sort of strip away the sort of scientific lingo and jargon, and really, you know, make the reach to a sort of a general, right, population, you know. And we, you know, of course, at the root of things is, you know, is the Penn community, but I think our impact needs to, and does, right, go well beyond that.
I totally agree. And it's kind of funny, because the way that we ended up getting connected is actually through the Wharton Neuroscience Initiative, that they had reached out to HCD and our partners, IVP, to go and give a talk. So I can say from firsthand experience that there are, you know, they are including other people, so that way you can have a more comprehensive understanding of what's going on outside of the world of academics, or the world of, you know, just strictly neuroscience, because these things are being applied in marketing, it's being applied in technology and different, you know, app developments and things like that. So it is everywhere. And so it's really important for us to learn from each other and really see, because another thing that I find quite interesting is that timelines are different within academia versus industry. So problems and solutions, trying to understand them, there has to be a communication between both groups, basically, to have a holistic understanding of the best way to go about things, and be nimble and be flexible to get a better understanding and build those solutions. But I do want to also touch on that podcast that you mentioned. I did a little background research into it, and I listened to an episode, because it's relatively new, right, the podcast. But can you just share a bit more about this initiative you have? Because it's the Wharton VAT podcast. And what is that about? What does the VAT stand for?
Right. So I was just joked with by one of our upcoming speakers who's from the UK, who said VAT is not something that we should be using because it means value added tax for them.
Oh.
But we use it. We use it as an acronym just because it's a mouthful and a keyboard full. But the focus is on vulnerability, authenticity, and trust, and how we can sort of use neuroscience and human behavior to think about new methods for building that, which we know, you know, has pretty profound outcomes for high performing teams, both high performing individuals, but also high performing teams. And we were really interested in beginning to have a dialogue, a sort of a multidisciplinary dialogue about vulnerability, authenticity, and trust, because the neuroscience behind that is rather murky, right? Mm-hmm. So people don't even have general definitions actually of what that means from the neuroscience lens or the behavioral lens, right? And so at the same time, there have been so many recent conversations about why this is growing in importance for the workplace in particular, right? And we can see the kinds of things that have been showcased that have, you know, reached media attention are like in peak performance, like what was happening with the Olympics gymnastics, for example, or Naomi Osaka, right, refusing to do press conferences and then being slammed. You know, this idea of like, how do you stay true? How do you stay sort of true to your core mission while still conveying a sense of authenticity and how does one build on that? But these kinds of dialogues, you know, are not just in the realm of professional sports, right? These are impacting people's well-being. This is you know, definitely a conversation that's happening right now in medicine and healthcare, right? Which is like 80% of our service industry in the United States, right? Is healthcare related, and there are again real people behind those businesses, right? And the pandemic has sort of put a new strain, but also a new lens for us to sort of reimagine how we can optimize the workforce. And so that's really what those dialogues are aiming for, which is just really bring together business people, scientists, and others, right, to really think about, you know, the tools that we all have and how a cross-disciplinary conversation might actually empower businesses to think more thoroughly around even how they convey ideas around trust building.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that this is a really important initiative given the world that we're living in right now. We see with this idea that it's getting floated around that great resignation where everyone is losing that loyalty that they may have had to that company. Why is there no loyalty? It's because people are recognizing that the company isn't necessarily your family. And so how can you still convey that trust in an employee-employer relationship, so that way it is, you know, it is, there's that loyalty that you have, and that it's not just self-serving, but really benefiting both parties, because that's, you know, it's a transaction. The idea of working is this transaction of your time for value, and I think that companies, especially with so much scandal surrounding larger companies, you want to have that authenticity and that trust involved in it. And I do think that I'm appreciative that you include the term vulnerability in there as well, because these are vulnerable conversations and they're very challenging and complex topics to try to go through and uncover. And it's multifaceted and multi-layered. And I really applaud you for including things like that in here. I know from where we stand, we do a lot of research exploring emotions and the emotional states and things like that. And I thought it was funny how you introduced it saying, you know, there's not really definitions for these terms. And I'm like, well, there's not really a lot of definitions for emotion. like we really are struggling to have that understanding as to what these things mean. Have you had any guests on that you are particularly excited about, or you feel it's something that you really want to make sure other people hear about in terms of this podcast, just making sure that it came at the right time with the pandemic and the ongoing pandemic? Were there any lessons that you gleaned from chats that you've already had?
Absolutely. I think I learned something with each recording. So it's been really a remarkable series. We've only had three so far. Our fourth is coming up. But it's, you know, it's just like all of our guests have really been fascinating and really coming at it from a really different kind of perspective. So our last episode featured three amazing people. So Emily Nelson, who is the deputy chief flight director at NASA. So she's at the sort of at the helm, second in at command of sort of making sure that the International Space Station's, you know, operations stay. So
that's pretty impressive.
Pretty impressive. And NASA is a really interesting organization, as well as like to sort of you know, get a different kind of lens on how they make their decisions and, you know, how their leadership and their organizations are structured, that a lot of people don't have, you know, like outside of the organization don't have that much insight into. And she had just amazing things to say about how, you know, you have to value every person that at every stage of the hierarchy, because of course the people, like what she highlighted was that the people that are at the lowest hierarchy at NASA are the most critical, you know, just like, you know, how we're having these conversations around frontline workers. But you know, this idea that, you know, those are the experts, right? And if you disregard their data, if you disregard them and their value to an organization, then, you know, then leaders are really in peril. And I think those are really easy messages, but things that sort of get forgotten sometimes outside of those kinds of arenas. And so, yeah, I mean, there's so many extraordinary bits of information in those. So I would really encourage people to take a listen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it is really important, like you touched on with the frontline workers, that there is this appreciation for them, and it's not just a surface level appreciation. It's really listening to the wants and their needs, so that way that they, you know, can have better lifestyles and have a bit of wellness involved in their implemented into what they do. Because across the board, there's just been this burnout of people adjusting to working from home. And for those that can't work from home, you know, you have this appreciation for them, but they don't want just the title of whatever it is, you know, being called a hero is like, great, but I don't feel like a hero right now. I feel very tired and, you know, I need rest and very basic things. So it makes sense to almost reframe the way that you're looking at things. And I can speak to my program that I'm a part of, is that it's a really big part in behavioral science as well, just trying to get an understanding of how HR can better work to create initiatives within the workforce, so that way they can create a more sustainable way to live for their workers. And there's been so much research done on productivity and wellness and, you know, people experimenting with the 4-day work week and things like that. Like, there's all these different ideas that people have to just try to find that balance between work, you know, play and just like existing and like personal time, you know, it's and learning. It's all very important. And I think especially from, I have a younger sister who is really new in her career, and her perspective is going to be so much different than the person that's the senior for 20 years, because she understands how TikTok works. She understands how social media is influencing the people that she's caring for. So I do think that there has to be this shift in perspective and really appreciating what everybody can bring to the table, because again, it's that idea of appreciating all the opinions that are shared. Everyone's opinions are valid. But I do want to touch again on, I know you mentioned you also teach a class called visual marketing. Can you share a little bit about that and how that is, you know, how that's taking place? And I know it's quite popular among the students. So if you could share a bit.
Sure. So like I said, I co-instruct this with Barbara Kahn. And our idea was to sort of combine this idea of marketing and vision science, which already is an interdisciplinary approach that takes into account engineering principles, you know, how the eye works, the biology of seeing, to things like, you know, sort of cognitive neuroscience, but to think of it, you know, impacting design, you know, marketing strategy, all the rest. So that's what we sort of set out to develop. And really, I think the interesting thing about the class is not necessarily the combination of marketing and science, although I think that's that is somewhat new. And it's nice to be able to do that. But it's this sort of radical idea that marketing has to sort of keep pace with the sort of newness of the you know, arrays of media and how that's really changing marketing strategy really rapidly. So here's an area where academic research is lagging way, way far behind. And consumer insights is sort of leading the charge, but also the sort of, you know, tried and true sort of marketing attempts of sort of throwing the spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. I mean, maybe that's, you know, what's really working right now. And so it's just the, you know, sort of rapid pace of how different, you know, deployed strategies can get out there and how the, you know, sort of barrier to the cost of entry has gone down, except, you know, in the more standard ideas of, you know, packaging and retail design. Those are sort of standard, those aren't shifting, but this idea of like, how do you do that? You know, how do you optimize, you know, retail design and then direct to consumer? How do you think about, you know, online marketing only, all this stuff. And so our idea is to sort of teach, instruct about some of the fundamental limitations that there are just with the sort of biology and psychology of seeing, right? The kinds of information, what we can pay attention to, how much of that is hardwired, how much of that is flexible, and how we can start to think about then everything from how can we optimize engagement, attention getting, to thinking about, you know, new methods from a lot of different perspectives. How can you optimize consumer choice? How can you think about taking in new levels of data analytics to guide strategies, you know, where that's been working and where that hasn't been? A lot of it has actually been the sort of embedding of people who have backgrounds actually in vision science, onto multidisciplinary teams. Like the most successful strategies that you see out there are guided by these multidisciplinary teams. And so I think that, you know, if our students go out of the world and they become brand managers, you know, if they become brand strategists, those are the kinds of, you know, the sort of normal jobs that a lot of our students go on to do. And they think to themselves, oh, you know, that's not going to work. Or, you know, like, what if we tried this instead? Or what if I read, you know, this stuff that's related to optimizing whatever, right? I think we've gone on to do what we sort of aimed to do. So it's not really it's not a design class, you know, it's really just to sort of put out there the sort of fundamentals that shape our perceptions and that guide our actions, and to think about that from a marketing lens.
And would you be able to share why you decided to focus on visual cues as opposed to something like sound or smell? What brought you to the idea of perception and vision?
Yeah, so I mean, perceptions, of course, can be multimodal, right. And some of the most interesting things actually are multimodal, of course. But I'm a visual neuroscientist by training, so I didn't want to get into the realm of teaching a multimodal class. But also, you know, about 80% of our sensory information we prioritize is visual. So humans really prioritize the visual, So it's really important. It is not the only thing that matters, obviously, like smell and how things feel, right? Are also really critical. And you see all kinds of new things like audio logos, like, right. You know, there are definitely new things emerging that I acknowledge are really, you know, interesting. And of course, you know, there are these compounding things, right? A narrative is much better if it's got sound and, you know, visuals at the same time. It's much more powerful, much more emotionally driving. But what we really wanted to do is really to just focus on the visual messaging. And by that, not even the text. We don't really talk about text so much or reading. It really is sort of the pictorial aspects of sort of encoding, the semiotics, that kind of thing that we think about behind any marketing strategy, how a package looks, how a retail display might look, right?
A picture is worth a thousand words, right?
Absolutely, yes. And with that, is a grand challenge, right? Because you can also, instead of reading, you know, one of the reasons we don't focus on reading is because that's a serial process. It's also linked to language, right? It's symbolic, but pictures, right? People can sort of choose where and when to look at things. It's much more complicated.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting because we do some eye tracking research, and often people will come to us and they'll be like, can you do eye tracking research on this? And it's just text from head to toe. And you kind of go back and you're like, well, you can, but why would you? Like, I can tell you right now, the person's just going to read, and, you know, they might skim it or look at the first thing or the title and look at the bottom. But, you know, there's certain things that are more impactful when you're using eye tracking as a tool, such as, like you said, pictures or shelf testing, or even, you know, certain types of advertisements are really, you can make a big impact by using eye tracking to get a better understanding and get better insight into what the consumer is going through. I have one more question for you about the idea of visual marketing. And it's really just asking you about if you have any predictions about how the visual marketing is going to continue to change, because we've seen media change constantly over and over again. So I'm curious how you foresee it continuing to change and how this type of research is going to continue to be relevant.
Yeah, I mean, it is changing perpetually, right? So we can see in social media, right, which is probably the biggest reach right now to user engagement. I mean, there are some huge challenges there, right? We're being oversaturated with visuals all the time. So that means that there's even, you know, what's unseen is unbought. As a consumer insights expert, you know that. But yet at the same time, you know, there are ethical implications, right, for how we present information to people, and what has to be promoted, right, what has to be reported as being an advertisement, for example, and that's actually because we know of the power of those visuals. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that everything is moving towards being quick, you know, movie related, dynamic stimuli rather than static images,
right,
is, I think that's taking over, but I also think that there may be like a pendulum swing back, because again, like if you don't have something that stands out, if everything in a feed looks the same, it's going to be hard.
Mindless scrolling. Yeah.
And
it makes sense.
Yeah, if you only have, you know, if you only have less than a second, right, to get someone's attention before they've moved on, I think there are really some phenomenal challenges, I think, with advertising in particular. But at the same time, I think there are some amazing opportunities that we've, you know, in businesses that we've seen emerge, where people are using different kinds of data analytics. Right. And as consumers, people like to get more precise, things that feel more personalized and more catered to them. So there's also just a phenomenal, you know, aspect to the kinds of data. Some of it, you know, definitely has ethical implications that, you know, that we're going to have to see how those are guided, in how we regulate this kind of thing. But at the same time, I think, you know, the consumer really does like to be matched with something that they prefer. So there's also these really amazing opportunities to get more and more, you know, precise and individualized data that can help make, you know, people find the things that they want and that they'll like.
Absolutely. So. And it's funny because I've had that same thought about the pendulum swing, where I wonder how something like a meme is going to be much more impactful than, like you said, that short form video or something in a form of traditional advertising, like a 30 second long television ad is going to have a very different type of reaction compared to someone that can relate to a meme that has something superimposed on it with a clever, quick caption. It really seems like the world is focusing on streamlining, and it seems like everyone's focusing on keeping things simple. But time will tell, you know, we'll find out as things go along. But I do think what you were saying in terms of the ethics surrounding it is going to become very prevalent. And this ties beautifully into why your podcast is so important as well for visual marketing. But I do want to play a game with you. I know I warned you about it off for the recording, but we have a game that we want to play here where it's called React Attack. It's just you share whatever comes to your mind. It's a rapid fire implicit test, but you can't get it wrong. There's really no harm, no foul. Are you ready to get started? I have my 10 words up and ready to roll.
I am ready, I guess.
I promise there's no wrong answers. All right, so first word is going to be teaching.
Students.
Brand.
Identity.
iPhone.
Our whole universe.
Fair. Perception.
Reality.
The color yellow.
Bananas.
Decisions.
Optimizing.
Packages.
Grabbing.
Attention.
Neural mechanisms.
Shopping.
Opportunities.
And the final word is eyes.
Windows to the soul.
Oh, it's a great way to end it. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure chatting with you. And I've had quite a few conversations with you. Every time I talk to you, I enjoy our conversation. So I just really want to thank you for your time today. And can you share how people can find you if they have any questions for you, or find the Wharton Initiative if they're interested in it? Can you share a bit of how they can connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously we're on social media. We have our Twitter handle is Wharton Brain. And of course we have a website, which is neuro.wharton.upenn.edu. And of course my email is always open. So that can be found by going to our website.
Amazing. Thank you so much again. And we look forward to chatting with everybody next time, but until then, take care and stay safe. Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine.
HCD Mindset is produced by Helen Ross. For more information or updates, follow HCD Research on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at HCD Research Inc. and at HCD Neuroscience. Subscribe to our YouTube channel and be sure to rate, review, and follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you, and stay tuned for more curious conversations.